This is the Observations Podcast for Sunday, the 2nd of February, 2024. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Dale Franks. And I cannot hear Michael Wade.
I'm still Michael Wade.
Okay, there we go. Maybe I just had your volume down a little too much. Oh, well, we had a hiatus last week, and so we missed talking about a lot of stuff. However, since last week, a lot of other stuff is
it hasn't stopped rolling.
So the circus continues as the Trump administration goes into, well, now I guess it's going into its third week tomorrow. What I wanted to do, and let me fiddle with some volume here just a little bit more. What I wanted to do was take a look at some of the executive orders and talk about them, especially the first one, because it seems like culturally this may be the most important executive order that Trump signed, and he signed it on day one whenever he went in. And that was the order, let me add you to the screen there. That was the order for the DEI stuff. Just getting rid of DEI. There were some ancillary ones about, you know, additional, you know, terms about what is a man and what is a woman. So he did the transgender things. But basically, he has just thrown DEI completely out of the window in federal hiring, in contracting, in affirmative action, and in everything else. And it's a very thoroughgoing order. And it's going
all the way back to 1965. Yes. Under LBJ.
Yes, basically he's saying all of the discriminatory actions. Discriminatory is kind of a loaded term, but basically it is a true term in that you can't resolve past discrimination with current discrimination. Is the argument. And, you know, the argument is it's been since 1964 that we've had the Civil Rights Act. Maybe it's time to actually enforce it as written. And it's difficult for me to make any argument against that. The other interesting thing, and I just wanted to grab it just quickly. That's not the one we wanted. I meant to mark it and I didn't mark it because I there was something that was very interesting in it. It was the transgender one, forget it. I'm not going to look for it, but in the transgender one, the way it was written, it specifically defined a man as being, you know, at conception, being of the sex that produces the smaller reproductive cells, and a woman, the larger reproductive cells. And you're either or. There's no self-identification or anything like that. That together with the DEI one is really interesting because this is part of what he was elected to do, right? I mean, this was part of what he said he was going to do. And I think a lot of us have had to deal with sort of the HR-led, you know, you should put your pronouns in your bio or in your email signature and, you know, all of this other stuff that we've been getting from sort of the Karen culture that we've had for the last, you know, 10 or 15 years or so, that really has been running everything, you know, Hollywood, everything. I mean, all you have to do is look at, like, you know, BioWare's last game, the Dragon Age game, where basically you had to either be supportive or join in and be, you know, transgender, non-binary, or whatever. I mean, we've had this constant cultural push for this. And I'm wondering if this is an indication that culture's on the way out.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is a big indicator. I mean, it basically just flipped it all on its head. And that is exactly what he was elected to do. Normal people are absolutely tired of this. It is a very small, vociferous minority that pushes this stuff. And it's all from the top down. And it's given all these euphemistic sounding reasons, but it's really just to destroy American culture. That's really all it is.
I take your point about the destruction of American culture. I think for most people, it goes. I don't think they think of it in cultural terms. I don't think most people think of things in cultural terms. What I think is that there are, yes, there is a small group of people who have a nefarious goal for all of this stuff. I think it gets joined up by a lot of people who enlist in the cause because they've been told over and over and over again that this sort of suicidal empathy is a requirement for proving you're a good person.
Right. Well, when we talked about this a couple weeks ago, I think, with the losing or the shying away from the leaving religion that's gone on over the past several generations, there's no touchstone anymore. Culture is that thing you don't think about, but it somehow still kind of controls how you act and what you say and how you treat people. And religion is part of that. When you are devoid of any real methods of proving virtue or being virtuous, well, you turn to what you can, and what people see is that, wow, if I'm really nice to these people, and I force other people to be nice to these particular people, that makes me pretty virtuous, doesn't it?
Yeah, and if I weaponize my compassion, it makes me even more
Yeah.
virtuous.
I'm a holy warrior.
Yeah, exactly. Not only do I have the right ideas, but I can force other people to. Well, here's the problem. I can never force you to think what I want you to think. I can only force you to say it. And for
Right.
most people, as long as I can force you to say it, I win.
Yeah, well, it's true. And I mean, that's what Orwell wrote about, right? Was that, removing these words from the language means you can't even think that way anymore. I mean, these
Yeah.
words don't exist.
Yeah, there's no way to describe the feelings that you're having because, that was the whole point of Newspeak in 1984. We're going to make the language so circumscribed that the only ideas you can express are ideas that the party wants you to express.
Right.
And of course, the goal of that was ultimately to control thought. But, you can never quite do it. It always reminds me of back in the early 80s, there's a Canadian military historian whose name is Gwyn Dyer. He wrote a book named War, and there was a PBS series about it, which he hosted. And he was talking about conscription and how conscription, really reforces the thinking, refocuses the thinking of 18-year-olds. It tears them down and builds them up. And he did have one little thing that he said. He said, "Now, you can take older men and put them through basic training and make good soldiers out of them, but you can never quite make them think that they like it." And that is the whole point of this DEI stuff, is we can make you say it, but the problem is you can never quite make you think that you like it.
Yeah.
And you'll go along because you have to, because there's discipline, there are consequences if you don't. And having the federal government now just turn around and for the next 4 years, presumably, all of this DEI stuff is going, and Trump is firing the DEI people. That's been the interesting thing. He just said, "Okay, well, now you're all on administrative leave. Don't worry about coming into work." This has the potential, if he can run this through for 4 years, this has the potential of, and I think we're already seeing a little bit of it, of filtering down into industry to just saying, "Okay, maybe we went a little too far with this DEI stuff and forcing people to sign on to this ideology." And I think the transgender stuff goes hand in hand with that. We do stuff in this country, vis-a-vis transgender. For example, the transitioning of children. I mean, even the Brits have stopped that, and they're way off onto the left as compared
Almost
to
all of
us.
Europe has stopped doing it.
Yeah, so, this We have, and part of this transgender thing, boy, wow, this has a lot more implications than I even thought of when I decided I wanted to talk about it. We have a cultural thing in this country that I've noticed. I started noticing it really strongly via COVID, and that is this cult of scientism. Not science, scientism. And this credulous acceptance of everybody who's an expert who says, well, this is what the science says. Tony Fauci, just, probably the most memorable example of that. I am science, Judge Dredd, I am the law. And
Right.
media, everybody else just credulously accepted everything they said as the truth. And here we are 5 years later. And we're just openly talking about, oh yeah, the virus probably did come from the lab in Wuhan. Well, wait a second. 3 years ago, the science said that that was all a hokey, weird conspiracy theory.
Yeah, you were canceled if you say that.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't post it on Facebook. I mean, there are people who not only just got their posts banned or hidden, I mean, there are people who lost their accounts on social media for pushing this, which turns out to most likely to be the most likely cause of COVID. And
Yeah,
yet,
what's his face? Berenson was like bringing the receipts and everything, and he got banned.
and yet, because the experts said it, we decided to go ahead and not only accept it as the truth, but punish anyone who said something outside the truth. And the interesting thing about this transgender thing and the transgender child stuff is that doctors have said that this is the right thing to do, and people have just sort of got into line with that, and now that script is being flipped. And I think we really need to examine this whole idea of scientism that we seem to have gotten locked into, because there are a couple of major instances of it that have just turned out the science, quote unquote, turned out to be not the science at all.
Yeah, well, we've already seen this with, climate change, global warming, whatever. We saw it with Darwinism, at the beginning of the progressive era. This isn't something new. We get enamored with some, great idea or set of ideas, and well, the people who know what they're talking about all say the same thing. We should follow them. And I follow them because I am smart enough to know that they are right.
Yeah,
It's
well,
kind of part and parcel with the whole holy warrior thing.
yeah, well, there was a couple of interesting things. Number one, which hi chat, how are you doing? Inebriated Plutarch says, "Have you seen the video of the DNC trying to figure out their gender quota rules for leadership?" Yeah,
Yes.
however hilarious, they're not giving up. Just that was a comedy show in and of itself. We got to talk about
Yes,
that
it
because
was.
it
It was
is,
like an SNL skit.
yeah, because it is kind of related to what we're talking about here. But the problem is, every time in recent years that the experts have gone out on a limb, they've been wrong. And this declaration, like Anthony Fauci said, well, I am the science. Well, no, you're not. Science is a method of investigation. It's a way of thinking, but it's not a conclusion. It's not a destination. It's a means of transportation to a destination, but it's only a means of transportation. There is no settled science. No matter how much you say it, there are error bars that might get smaller and smaller. But this trust that people have in experts has really been squandered, and it's a squandering that started, years and years ago. When the most famous was Bob McNamara being pulled out of Ford Motor Company, where he was president, taking over as, defense secretary, and just making a complete balls up of the Vietnam War. And the fact that I believe it is 60% of high school graduates can't read at their at sixth grade level.
Yeah.
California is the worst in the country with an adult illiteracy rate of about 30%. It's 28 point something.
Chicago doesn't have any
Yeah,
at the 12th grade level who can read at grade level.
I saw that this week. And but wait a second. Education is run by literal experts. You have to go to
So they
college.
tell us.
You have to go to college. You have to get a degree. You usually have to get a master's degree in some sort of educational specialization. You then have to apply for certification by the state to become a teacher in a public school. You are then required, while you're a teacher, to undergo continuing education so that whenever you go to renew your teacher's certification, you can show that you've taken the requisite amount of postgraduate education for being a good teacher. Public school teachers are the literal embodiment of the term credentialed experts. They are literally experts who are credentialed by the state to teach our children. And yet, somehow, these experts can't graduate a high school class where every student can read.
Yeah. And we keep throwing more and more money at them.
Yeah, as
Of course, now a lot of that money goes to the actual teachers. A lot of that goes to DEI faculty and whatever else. The number of administrators to teachers is something like 40 to 1 or it's a ridiculous number.
Oh yeah, and you can go back historically and see it's like the graph just goes asymptotic for the number of administrators. I mean, it's like teachers stay steady, and the number of administrators is like on a logarithmic increase. It's and by the way, not just in public education. The same holds true at every university.
Yep, that's true.
It is the tail wagging the dog. But to get back to the DEI stuff, which thank you, Inebriated Plutarch, for your comment in chat. That watching the Democrats try to figure out who they should elect to leadership based on what must be the most complicated decision tree imaginable, trying to figure out whether they have the appropriate representation of gender, race, sex, sexual orientation.
Well, it's like there's a lot more ifs than thens.
It's we've been told, and we've been told continuously for years, diversity is our strength. No, diversity is an aspect. Diversity is a characteristic. It is neither positive nor negative. Diversity in and of itself doesn't confer any particular advantage or disadvantage. It is a value-neutral proposition. What
Well,
matters is
diversity of
merit.
thought. Yeah, well, absolutely, merit comes first, and within that cohort of meritorious candidates, I mean, you definitely the one thing that diversity can do is prevent groupthink, right? By bringing in different perspectives, different ways of looking at things.
Yeah, but we don't do
That's
that.
absolutely true.
We don't do that. We
No, we
use
don't.
race, gender,
We
and
use
sexual
proxies for
orientation
diversity,
as proxies, right?
right? And they don't make any difference whatsoever.
Yeah, I and which is the Democratic Party's problem. Look, we can have the most diverse Democratic National Convention leadership that you can possibly imagine, measured in terms of race, sex, and sexual preference. But we will all exactly think the same things, and we will all support
Exactly.
exactly the same policies, and we will not disagree on any sort of, fundamental belief. Well, okay, but what
And then
would,
we'll like Tim Walz's campaign manager to be the DNC head.
but what would be the difference if we had, 100 DNC board members who were the exact racial, sexual, and preferential,
Yeah, perfectly proportional.
perfectly proportional to America? And how would that be any different? than just getting a whole bunch of liberal white women and just making them all the DNC? What would we notice would be different about the diversity?
I can't imagine a thing, quite honestly.
Yeah, because making a shibboleth out of these immutable characteristics rather than actually doing the hard work of interrogating people about their beliefs and about their values and to see whether they agree or disagree with you and why they disagree. That's hard work. It's a lot easier just to say, well, hey, let's hire the black guy and the Asian woman.
The thing that gets me too is, well, if DEI is such a great thing, why do you get so upset when we say somebody's a DEI hire? I mean,
Yeah, you should be celebrating that. Well,
you're damn straight, buddy.
I think it's because deep inside they know what it means and they know that it's likely true.
It's
That
tokenism. That's all it is.
how dare you question the fact that we have this token whatever leading this organization. Okay, well, if you know it, the difference between me and you is that we both know the same thing. I'm just willing to say it, and you're not because it's uncomfortable. Because nobody likes to admit, okay, maybe I'm wrong about this.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's very interesting that that was one of his first priorities, and we'll see how that. How that sort of filters out into the corporate world because,
We've seen some movement there,
yeah.
from especially in the tech companies. And it does seem to be even at like what was it, BlackRock? Where they the big hedge fund, where they started changing how they're going to do their criteria and whatever. They were the big ESG people.
Yeah, and they're saying, you know what, this ESG thing may not be the way to go. And
Well, they're also
Vanguard,
getting sued, I think.
yeah, and Vanguard just completely backed off from it. Vanguard said, yeah, we're just not going to do ESG governance, and we're not going to release an ESG scorecard for anybody, and we're not going to use it to make our decisions, which I think is probably wise, because as the culture shifts, what you're going to start seeing, and I think they're reasonable enough to realize this, is that hey, you have a fiduciary responsibility.
Right.
And if I have to eat Alpo when I'm 75 because you blew all of
You
my
invested in Solyndra and
yeah.
a bunch of other boondoggles.
Yeah, I'm going to be pretty upset.
Yeah.
Your responsibility is to get me as much money as I can so that I can have a house and at least a car and not have to eat Alpo when I'm living on the income that derives from my investments with you. And those could become pretty significant lawsuits. I think part of the problem is everybody has been drawn into this. You know, tech has this problem where every time they release a new product, it's going to change the world. You know, we're going to make the world a better place. There are five seasons of Silicon Valley making fun of tech guys who have that sort of vision of themselves as, you know, as world historical visionaries who are going to improve mankind. You're not, you're a guy that makes software. Be happy with that. And a lot of this stuff, you know, comes out of this whole World Economic Forum where all the billionaires meet, right? And they talk about, well, you know, we're billionaires. We should be able to run your life because we can run it better than you can because, you know, we're billionaires.
And you
So,
will eat bugs and like it
yeah,
and
and
know
you'll,
nothing.
yeah, and that sort of thing really has gotten into, has really invaded the culture, especially the sort of the HR culture of large organizations. And, you know, the government and corporate HR people all come from the same place. They all come from the same schools. They've all had the same professors. They've all had the same indoctrination. And having the federal government just coming in and saying, yeah, no, that's not going to work anymore. We are ending that. That sends a message, and hopefully one that gets through to corporations as well.
Yeah, it does seem to, and I think you, like you said, it is partially cultural, and well, just reading the room. I mean, people are really sick of this nonsense, and they're sick of kowtowing, for no good reason,
Yeah.
just because somebody gets upset.
And by the way, that's one of the reasons why the DNC thing was just so hilarious to watch. Talk about an organization that cannot read the room. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. They can read the room. The trouble is
Yeah, that's what that room, but that's
the
the
only
only
people
people.
in that room are them. And so they don't realize how, I think they literally don't realize how ridiculous it looks to regular people. Look, the Democrats still haven't figured out why they lost this election. There's still Democrats running around going, Kamala Harris ran a flawless campaign. No,
It
she
was the
didn't.
sexism and the misogyny and
Well,
the
yeah, that was the first thing they
racism.
that was the first thing they did. How many of you think that she lost because of sexism or racism and misogyny? And every single person raised their hand.
So, oh, good. We're starting off on the right page then.
Sure, because you're always going to be on the same page, no matter how
It's
diverse
just,
you are.
it's amazing to me. It's like they really don't want. They don't want to win unless they can win their way. And their way is for everybody to be evil but them.
Yeah, well, again, it is a religious. We've talked about this for 20 years now. It is a Manichaean religious view of the world. I have the proper moral views. You have sex with goats. There's no,
That's right.
there's no moral equivalence between us because there's
Well,
no.
for you to even oppose or question my virtuosity,
Oh yeah,
not
there's.
virtuosity,
Yeah.
virtual virtuousness is to point yourself out as being in the evil one. I mean, anything opposed to me is by definition pure evil.
Yeah,
That's the Manichaean.
because the argument is there can't possibly be a good faith argument against what I believe. Even if the argument is a consequentialist one. Your policies cause bad results. Doesn't matter.
Even if it hurts the very people you say you're going to help.
Yeah, because my intentions are good. Well, you know what's paved with good intentions? But,
I can't remember who said it, but
you can't
there was
reason
somebody
someone
that's.
out of a position they didn't reason themselves
Yeah.
into.
I still love that. I can't remember who said it, but somebody mentioned that the kind of along the lines of the neatest trick the devil ever pulled, the neatest trick that the left ever pulled was to turn everybody's opinions that they oppose into a question of motives. What motivates them? Why are they doing this? Oh, it's because they're evil, they're greedy, they're narcissistic.
Yeah, and the second you start questioning motives instead of arguments, I know that you're not arguing in good faith.
Right.
Well, let's move along because I have several things teed up here, and we've already spent half an hour just talking about the DEI stuff. Although I think that's the most consequential, except for the last thing we're going to talk about. But let's talk about some of the other executive orders that I thought were very interesting. The Biden administration signed off on this WHO deal where if there is another pandemic, WHO can basically dictate to all of the member states what policies they have to implement. And the Biden administration signed on to that. And that seemed like a big power grab, but not one that I care much about, I guess, anymore, because Donald Trump is withdrawing from the UN's World Health Organization, the WHO, and then
I'm not
they,
even sure that was legal to begin with, but
yeah, I would think that that would require a Senate,
I would think. I mean, that's basically a treaty, right?
yeah, that would require a Senate confirmation.
We would be removing power from the United States from our elected representatives.
Yeah, that would require a ratification in the Senate, it seems to me. But I mean, you are talking about the president who, on the last day of his presidency, declared that there was a 28th Amendment to the Constitution. So, Joe's fidelity to the Constitution was somewhat questionable. But in this case, pulling us out of the WHO, I have to wonder, is this going to be part of a larger effort along the way? Is this the first shot across the bow? Because in his first administration, Trump did notify the WHO that we were pulling out. And I wonder if this is just a standalone item or part of a larger effort to simply remove the United States from several key areas in the United Nations.
I think it's certainly a shot across the bow of NATO. It's certainly a shot across the bow of the UN. I mean, there are plenty of people who've been wanting us to get out of the UN and kick them out of Turtle Bay for decades. Something that I tend to agree with, third world debating society that gives as much prestige to Iran and Saudi Arabia as it does the United States and Canada. I mean, that's just ridiculous on its face.
It's also another artifact, like NATO is, of the post-World War II international settlement.
Yeah, you should include a link to that thing you wrote about getting out of NATO in the comments or somewhere.
Okay, I'll put a link to it in the comments whenever we
It was a good
finish
post.
the podcast. Well, I mean, we can always find it. You can always find pretty much what I write. You can always find on Twitter. So if we go to, well, it's not Twitter anymore. It's X. So in my profile, I have several articles.
Yeah, there it is.
One of which is why we should get out of NATO. The other of which is the NATO is sort of a more specific distillation of this article here about the end of the post-World War II era. So if you're interested in either of those, feel free to read those there, X articles. That's where I've started writing rather than writing on a blog. Blogs are pretty much dead at this point,
They're
so.
dead. Yeah. Unless you're Instapundit or like Hot Air.
Yeah,
Yeah.
basically, you have to have a brand. And, Instapundit has PJ Media. Hot Air has, what, Hot Air is, well,
Town,
Town Hall. Yeah, Town Hall.
Town Hall, yeah.
So, they have media groups
They're all
behind
under
them.
the same umbrella.
Yeah, ultimately they are. But I found the WHO thing interesting, especially because we're now just going to get, apparently we're just going to get out of it. All right, so let's get into some
And that's a
of
good thing. I mean, they have not done, they're not, they're dominated by the Chinese and by, interests that are at variance with ours. Yet we pay the most money and get the least benefit.
yes, and we're the people who set it up in the first place. So it's a, I mean, it did replace the League of Nations, although it has turned out to be, over the long term, about as useful as the League of Nations,
Yeah.
as the League of Nations was. All right, well, we talked about Biden's pardons. Let's talk about Donald Trump's. Now, there were some commutations on this. So he listed a whole bunch of people who had been convicted of rather naughty things, and so he's gonna say, okay, fine, you're good for time served, and you're out. But everybody else gets a full, complete, and unconditional pardon to all other individuals convicted of offense related to events that occurred at or near the United States Capitol on January 6, 2021. So blanket J6 pardons, with the exception of those people that were listed there above. What do we think about that?
I'm perfectly fine with that. I think they were political prisoners to begin with. Some of them absolutely committed violent acts, There weren't many, but there were some that did commit violent acts. But they've been in jail now for 4.5 years. Seems to me like they paid the price. And then you have what's his face, head of the Proud Boys, former head of the Proud Boys, Ario.
Yeah, that's the Oath Keepers, I think.
Wherever he is, he wasn't even in the areas of Florida.
No, he was convicted for seditious conspiracy because he was telling people what to do via text on his phone.
Supposedly, allegedly,
yeah, allegedly. yeah, I think one of the big problems that I have with a lot of the J6 convictions is the way they added the additional charges on for the preventing an official act charge,
right?
Which does not seem to be applicable, and which the Supreme Court said no, you can't do that. Ultimately,
well, it was that and the what was it? It was like one of the FinCEN things, or it was something that came out of the crash in 2007, 2008. Or no, I'm sorry, out of Enron.
Enron, yeah.
And they got charged with like some weird derivation of that law. What's it called? It's called gold. Shoot, I can't remember the name of it now. But and the Supreme Court ruled that no, that's not what this law's about at all. You stretch it too far. The taffy is breaking.
Yeah, so I don't know, 4 years I think is probably enough for anybody. I just thought it was interesting.
I would think so.
I just thought it was interesting that all those people who got convicted, which, you know, the vast majority were convicted of things like, you know, unlawful parading.
Right.
Or trespassing.
Little old ladies.
Yeah.
Yeah, some tour inside the velvet ropes.
Some meemaw from South Dakota who showed up there. Yeah, their record is now wiped clean. And so people,
yeah, like, I think that's, you know, justice.
So people like Brandon Straka, who did go to jail and who never set foot inside the Capitol,
mm-hmm.
You know, he can now talk about the sort of plea bargains, and you know, the government was pretty ruthless about that. Now that's all swept away. They are as pure and as innocent as any of Joe Biden's close relatives. So they get to walk. And of course, by the way, don't come back to me now and tell me about, oh, well, he shouldn't have done the J6. That's just a broad expansion of the president's power, which is plenary, by the way.
They were actually charged with something.
Yeah, at least they were not, you know, preemptive pardons. I pardon you for anything that you've done since 2014. But if you're going to go out and defend that for Joe Biden, okay, cool. Now you can keep your mouth shut about the J6 pardons.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, that...
And how many of those people who were pardoned hadn't even had their court date yet? They've been in jail.
Oh, that's
since
true.
2001.
There have been people who've been in pretrial.
I mean, 2021.
Yeah, there have been people who've been in pretrial convention for or pretrial detention for 4 years now. Don't they get habeas corpus? Don't they get to at least
right?
wait for a trial? Yeah, there's, you know, the whole D.C. circuit is problematic, I think, for a number of reasons. But
yes, it is.
You know, also maybe self-government for D.C. was a bad idea.
Probably.
Another quickie. The 51 former intelligence officials who signed on to the Hunter Biden laptop thing as all Russian disinformation have now lost their security clearances. And John Bolton. He just all these people and John Bolton. So he just named them all and said, okay, now you've lost your ability to consult with the federal government. And by the way, these people all had top secret clearances, all of them top secret, specially compartmented information. Okay, those security clearances, when you leave government service, are like bags of gold.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you can go into the private sector and you can consult, and they don't have to pay for that, because that is a super, super expensive clearance process to go through. If they can pull you in as a consultant or a board member or whatever with that clearance, you can make bank, and the company saves millions of dollars, and they get the cachet of having a former, you know, director of Central Intelligence or head of the FBI or whoever.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
On their board, and it's a good deal for everybody.
If you, well, except for us Americans.
Yeah, you take that clearance away, and all of a sudden those people are useless.
Pretty much, yeah.
Because that clearance
I've loved watching John Brennan, the commie John Brennan, cry and whine about this. That's been absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, your tears are a delicious elixir to me. So they're gone. Any post-government careers they might have had that required that security clearance is gone. And then this week, Donald Trump came back and said, hey, about those guys who I got rid of their clearances, they're not allowed in any government building either. How about that?
So, fair enough.
So not only do they have, here's the thing. He says they're not going to be allowed into any federal government building. So does that mean they have to drop their mail off at the little box outside the post office? Because that's a federal government building.
They can't go to federal court?
Well, look, that's the judiciary. He can't keep them out of a building run by the judiciary. But he can keep them out of any executive branch building. So I just have this, you know, everybody's got Clapper and Brennan photos at the front door, all the security people. So if they happen to walk through, they can just immediately arrest them for trespassing on federal property. But yeah.
Who was it? Was it Mark Elias?
Mark Elias, yeah.
Who still had like not only FBI privileges but top secret clearance. He was able to just kind of go in and out as he pleased.
Yeah, pretty much. It's good when you work at the senior levels of the Democratic Party. And by the way, why are we allowing? Look, I understand the idea behind allowing all these former intelligence officials to keep their clearance, because you may want to call them back in and consult with them about things. And so, I mean, it seems like a good idea to just let them keep their clearance as a courtesy. But like I said, those clearances are bags of gold for these people. And, you know, maybe we should have. There might need to be some sort of. If you need to talk to Clapper or Brennan again, I can't imagine why this administration would. But if you ever needed to, you could always
give them a temporary clearance.
Yeah, you can always give them a temporary clearance. You can always let them back in temporarily. I think
you read them into a specific file. You don't have to have
Exactly. I don't think there's a reason to give these people, or just to allow these people as a courtesy, and that's what it has been, to keep these top secret clearances to do. Well, you know,
it's part of their extra compensation.
Yeah, because they can end up at General Dynamics or wherever.
Raytheon,
sure. And they become very useful there with those secret clearances. Another one here that we'll hit real shortly, the assassinations thing. They're going to release the assassination files. My expectation...
About damn time.
Yeah, my expectation is that the reason they've been classified is because... They showed the intelligence services were incompetent buffoons. Now, probably not with Martin Luther King, because I think James Earl Ray was just James Earl Ray. He was just a racist who killed Dr. King. But and Sirhan to Sirhan, I don't think there's any real mystery there about who Sirhan Sirhan was.
Yeah, I don't either.
The JFK thing. My suspicion is, A, that Oswald did shoot JFK, and B, he should have been so high on the FBI's radar.
Yes.
That
having defected to the USSR. and then come back.
And then having traveled to Mexico to go to the Cuban embassy the week before, it seems like there are a lot of people at the FBI who dropped the ball. And what I expect these declassified,
Danger, Will Robinson.
yeah,
Danger.
I expect these classified documents to show that the FBI just incompetently dropped the ball on this.
I expect, yeah.
And if I'm wrong, and there's all of the stuff about somebody on the grassy knoll or whatever, well, it'd be good to know that too. But I think the reason this has been classified for so long, and by the way, this is why I think a lot of things get classified in the government, is because people have no idea how incompetent the government is and how often stuff falls through the cracks.
Yeah.
And so classifying stuff is a good way of just keeping the public from ever knowing that we have no idea what we're doing.
Well, if you've ever been to the site of his assassination,
I have.
you'd realize that where he was shot from, it's a lot closer than it appears in the Zapruder film. It's like, I mean, you're basically right on top of the street.
I mean, you can throw a rock from where Kennedy was shot and hit the school book depository. I mean, it's not like he was a block away.
Yeah, exactly. But it looks so much, I guess, broader and like more open.
Yeah, Dealey Plaza is like a couple of 100 feet wide.
It's not really that big a deal.
And the where the limousine turned is the Texas School Book Depository is like
It's right on the border.
just across the sidewalk. I mean,
Right.
the car turned 10 feet away from the Texas School Book Depository. It was, and that me and he was on the sixth floor, so that would have put him 60 feet up. So he was 60 feet away from the president when he started
Yeah.
shooting. So, yeah,
With a long range rifle. I mean,
So I don't think that's going to be a, I think we're going to learn a lot about government incompetence, not a lot about
oh, by the way, speaking of
conspiracy.
rifles, quick aside. Yesterday, I took my wife and daughter to the local, the Dulles town center for the gun show. I've never seen so many M1 Garands in my entire life. They were all kinds of conditions, obviously all from different manufacturers and whatever, some refurbished, some in original condition and whatever. And they're amazing rifles, but holy fuck, are they heavy? They're really fucking heavy.
Yeah, I'm surprised that there are, even the civilian marksmanship program, which since the end of World War II has been passing out M1 Garands like candy.
Yeah, that's what they mentioned to us. It was one of the ways to get one.
Even they're kind of out of them.
Yeah.
They're all out of M1 carbines. So they're kind of hard to find. I picked mine up probably about 15 years ago at the Crossroads of the West gun show. And it's not even it. Well, it's technically a World War II M1. The serial number has a shows a manufacturing date of about March of 45. So technically, it was manufactured before VE Day. Whether it actually got into anybody's hands prior
Right.
to August of 45, seriously doubt it. And mine was in good condition, which also makes me think it didn't get into some GI's hands before the
Right.
end of the
Didn't
war in
get mudded
45.
up.
Yeah, exactly. So they're so expensive now. CMP was given
The cheapest one we saw was like maybe $1,300, $1,400.
Oh yeah, CMP was giving those things away for like 100, 150 bucks 15 years ago. And actually, for mine, I paid nine when I got it. But mine was in pristine shape. I mean, mine was like it had been in storage since 1945.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some relatively expensive ones that CMP had. But yeah, they're getting
I was just
harder and harder
surprised
to
at
find.
how incredibly heavy they were,
9.6 pounds unloaded.
and then carrying it around on your back along with all your ammo, your rucksack, your provisions. Wow. You must be carrying 100 pounds.
Yes, you are. generally,
Yeah.
your combat load was somewhere between 100 and 120 pounds, and
Yeah, that's just incredible.
you had to ruck that across country for, in like the case of the, first infantry division, you had to ruck that across the country for 241 combat days.
Yeah. They had some 1908s there too, and a bunch of Colts, but no peacemakers.
Yeah,
But it was pretty cool.
if it wasn't for the fact that 30-06 is so expensive to shoot now, I wouldn't mind getting one of the.
They have them chambered for 308.
Well, I wouldn't mind getting one. Well, I tell you what isn't chambered for 308, the M1917 Enfield.
Yeah.
I'm sure you could probably get an M1903 Springfield that is chambered in 308. I'm sure they have them. But I doubt any of the M1917s would be. Those would all be 30-06.
Yeah.
Unless you got one of the British versions, in that case it'd be 303. If you think 30-06 ammo is expensive,
Oh, geez.
try buying British 303. All right, well, all of this
Anyway,
stuff.
sorry for that aside. It was just something that was kind of interesting that happened this week.
Yeah, all of this stuff has been warm up, by the way, to what happened this week.
I know where we're going.
President Donald J. Trump imposes tariffs on imports from Canada, Mexico, and China. So President Trump is taking bold action to hold them accountable for their promises of halting illegal immigration and stopping poisonous fentanyl and other drugs from flowing into the country. Okay, I have no problem with doing that. The tool chosen is 25%, or is the actual number here? Ah, yes. China and Mexico, a 25% tariff on all products coming into the United States.
Mexico and Canada.
Yeah, Mexico and Canada, except for oil supplies. Oil supplies from Canada only going to be 10%.
That's because we get those from there.
That's because we import a lot. They're our largest importer of petroleum. So it's only 10%. 25% for Canada, 25% for everything from Mexico, and then for the tariffs that are currently on China, an additional 10%. Now, I have some dim memory about the 1930s not being a great time, and they largely weren't a great time because of what we now call the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. It was actually the United States Tariff Act of 1929 or whatever it was. What happened was in 1930, we threw a whole bunch of tariffs on foreign goods, tens of thousands of them. Other countries, whenever they saw that we were
Mostly
going to.
like agricultural goods and textiles, right?
Yeah, and the tariffs were an average of 40 to 60%. So other countries decided that wasn't very friendly, so in retaliation, they threw tariffs on us. So in 1930, when we really, really needed trade and exports,
Some competition.
global trade declined by 65%. So, how much money did those tariffs make us? Not much. And of course, we then spent the rest of the 1930s with 25% unemployment. Doesn't Donald Trump know this? I mean, he always refers to McKinley and back in 1904. And how, we had so much money, we just didn't know what to do with it. Well, you know why we had so much money? There was no Social Security. There was no Medicare. There was no welfare. There was no Medicaid. The United States Army in 1890 was 2,100 officers and 26,000 enlisted men. The United States Navy had 38 ships. One cruiser, one steel gunboat, and 36 freaking ironclads. The U.S. government spent 2.7% of GDP in 1890. So, yeah, tariffs could probably work. Also, everybody had tariffs back then. But I thoughtthat the Smoot-Hawley experience taught us that tariffs just didn't work. And by the way, once we decided we wanted Social Security, tariffs were not going to pay for that. We made the decision right. against tariffs back then. And the only way that we were going to pay for the type of programs that we wanted was through an income tax. Now, I'm all 100% against the income tax. But this idea that we are going to, by the way, you know what the total value of U.S. trade was in 2023, the last year for which we have a full number? The total value of all goods that were imported into the United States in 2023 was $3.8 trillion. The federal government in 2023, meanwhile, spent $6.7 trillion. And Trump talks about this, you know, we'll have a Department of External Revenue, as if the foreigners have to, I don't know, deposit money in a bank whenever they drop the goods off at port. That's not how it works. It's not a, he says, we're going to make the Chinese pay. Chinese aren't going to pay jack. Chinese don't pay anything. It's the people who buy the goods who pay the tariffs, which is, by the way, the same problem with any sort of income tax on American companies. You know, I always talk about what the income tax rate is for corporations and corporate tax rate. And we need to make corporations pay their fair share. Corporations don't pay jack. Those taxes are a cost of goods sold. We pay it anytime we buy something from those corporations. Tariffs work the same way.
We and the shareholders, yeah.
No. Shareholders don't pay. Companies raise prices on consumers to pay
That's right. And they raise them up to the point that they can and then absorb the rest. And then the shareholders take the hit. In supposing they're getting dividends, they're going to get less in dividends.
Well, it's a dumb argument. I mean, it's literally a dumb argument. And it's an argument I thought we had settled in the 1930s. And certainly at the end of World War II, everybody said, okay, we're not going to do that again because it's too damaging to our economies. So we're not going to have a high tariff regime. And by the way, this is something that the British did at the end of the Napoleonic Wars. One of the reasons why the British were so pissed off with us about the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act is that the British were telling us, we learned this during the Napoleonic era. That's why we became a free trade nation after 1815, because we needed the money. And everybody makes money if you have free trade. I just don't understand how Trump is so attracted to tariffs. I don't understand how he thinks we're going to make foreigners pay, because foreigners don't pay tariffs anyway. We pay them when we buy their stuff. This Department of External Revenue, Americans will never be taxed. I just don't understand how he can possibly believe any of that.
Yeah, well, setting that external revenue thing aside, part of the idea here is to boost industry here and to stop the outflow of manufacturing and building things. And he's on to something there, because it worked before. I am in general agreement, and always will be, that all else being equal, our tariff rate should be zero, regardless of what tariffs we're facing elsewhere. I know in the long run that will work out better for us. But what we've seen with the globalization of the economy is that we have lost a lot of jobs. We have lost a lot of ability to make things that are important to us here, like chips and medicines and rare earth metals. These things are pretty important, and we don't have control over that. That creates a national security problem. I also understand, at least how Trump is thinking about it, is that you need to get control over your borders and stop having people, just roam across them willy-nilly with fentanyl and whatever else. We're not doing that anymore. We're closing it down. And this is an incentive to do that. Will it work out that way? I mean, I think there's going to be some compromise. I think there's going to be some movement one way or the other.
Well,
but like you said, it's a tool. It's not necessarily a solution.
Both the Canada and Mexico have come back and said, okay, fine. Then we'll just put 25% tariffs on everything you bring over.
They already have tariffs on stuff we send there.
But now they're going to have tariffs on everything. And by the way, we have a trade deficit with Canada. It's not a huge one. It's only about $50 billion, but
it's our largest trading partner.
But yeah, there are bilateral trade. Even with Canada, we have a $50 billion trade deficit. But of course, we do a lot more than 50
once
billion
Trudeau is out of there and Poilievre is in, I think that we're going to have a lot more amenable relations with Canada.
Maybe. The problem is that tariffs are such... I have two problems. One of which is, if Donald Trump were to come out and say, look, tariffs aren't great. We don't want to kick off a global trade war because, especially now that, as far as trade goes, we import a hell of a lot more stuff than we export. And Canada and Mexico, especially, anything that we still make here is probably made out of parts from Canada and or Mexico, like, cars. So if Trump were to come out and say, look, tariffs are a negotiating tool. We'll use them if we have to. We'll impose them if we have to.
I think he has said that.
But read the executive order. That's not what it says. It says you have to do X, Y, and Z or we're throwing tariffs on you. And by the way, how are tariffs related to fentanyl or drug cartels?
They're just simply a tax for not controlling their borders.
Okay, well, I don't know if there's enough Canadians to control their borders.
We just got 40. Somebody just got caught bringing 43 pounds of fentanyl across the Canadian border.
Yeah, I know, but there's only like 30 million Canadians and they have a border that goes 3,500 miles across. I mean, there aren't quite enough Canadians to actually guard that border. I think we need to do a lot more guarding of the Canadian border than the Canadians will ever be able to do. The average county in Canada, outside of, Ottawa or Toronto or Calgary, is basically about as well populated as the average county in North Dakota. So,
yeah, it's like Wyoming's, a whole bunch of Wyoming's.
Exactly. And that's near the American border. You go any further north and you're in the wilderness, my friend. It's just,
yeah, the vast majority,
you and the
I
bears.
Think it's like 90% of the population lives within 25 miles of the American border.
Yeah, 90% of Canadians live within 100 miles of the United States. 90%. That's a lot.
It's the warmest they can get.
Yeah. So my fear is that this kicks off kind of a trade war. Now, I'm glad that he started off with just these targeted tariffs because I think at least a targeted tariff, you can, make some argument that it's just a tough negotiating tactic. My fear is this whole idea that there's going to be a Department of External Revenue and we're going to just bring tariffs back and we're going to be so rich. That kind of language is,
well, you know why
a
he
lot
brought
more
that up. He was talking about replacing the income tax with it. And it, before we had the income tax, and what was that, 1916? We paid for the federal government through excise taxes and tariffs and fees and, you know,
Sure.
whatever
A
else.
government that spent 2% of GDP.
Right.
A government that spends a little north of 25% of GDP, that's a whole new ball game.
Especially when about a fifth to a fourth of what we're spending is just on interest payments.
Well, yeah, $1 trillion of what we have to pay out now every year is going to be in interest payments, and that number is only going to rise, by the way.
It will.
If you want to get rid of, look, we can get rid of the income tax, but somebody needs to tell Donald Trump that we're not going to do it with tariffs.
Tariffs are not a permanent solution. That's absolutely right. They're not a solution. They are a tool to negotiate with, but they're not a solution.
Yeah, and they're
That's
certainly,
absolutely true.
yeah, but Trump has been talking about getting rid of the income tax and getting rid of the IRS and having a Department of External Revenue and paying everything through tariffs. That is literally impossible.
I think he's also thinking about starting to charge countries that we have bases in for protecting them.
Yeah,
I know he's mentioned that before.
then they'll tell us to get the hell out.
It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine, but it's also not a source of revenue. And, what you tax, you get less of. So if you want to tax trade, you're going to get less trade, which means that we're not going to be able to export to these countries because they can't import to us. And so
We're
we'll
all
be,
Pagovians now.
it's just a, it's, look, if you want to get rid of the income tax, and I believe the income tax is philosophically incompatible with the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and its principles. I think the income tax allows the government far too much control over our private lives. It allows them to direct our behavior by changing how much of our money they're going to take. It requires us to provide the federal government, some faceless bureaucrat, with financial information we wouldn't willingly share with our own
Some
families.
very personal details. Yeah, that's right.
And it's done under force of law. Men with guns will come drag you screaming and naked out of your home if you don't tell them exactly how much money you made, or you don't do it correctly, or you don't pay at all.
Is kind of funny too, because every year you go and fill in that tax form and you're like, is that the right amount? And they're like, no, you got it wrong. It's like, well, if you knew what it was, why didn't you just send me a bill?
Well, that's the thing. If you ask the IRS, okay, how much do I owe if I do this and this and this? And you'll get an answer. And if you
Not
ask
going to be
it
a.
again, you'll get a different answer
Yeah, that's
because
exactly
they
right.
don't know what the law is. It is there is an arbitrariness to the complexity of the tax code that puts you at such a severe disadvantage to the government. But there should not be an income tax. Income taxation, as I said earlier, is fundamentally incompatible with our founding principles. So,
Absolutely.
if we want to spend $6.7 trillion a year, and apparently we do, then the only other alternative is a VAT. Replace the income
If you
tax
have a
with
VAT
a
and
VAT.
an income tax, I mean, that's
Well, that's what
now we're
the.
talking European levels.
Yeah, no, you have to rescind the income. You have to rescind the 16th Amendment. It has to be repealed. And once it is repealed, then you can implement a national VAT. It'd probably have to
Right.
be about 25% because we want to spend, as I said earlier, $6.7 trillion a year on an annual GDP of $28 trillion. So, if you're going to want to spend 25% of your national income on taxes, okay, then you're going to have a 25% VAT.
And the problem with the VAT is that it's very regressive.
Well,
whereas we have a very progressive income tax.
Well, by some measures, the most progressive, well, by almost any measure, the most progressive in the world in
yes.
terms of,
yeah.
of how the taxes are graded. You could make it a little less regressive. You could.
Yeah, you exempt like
non-prepared foods.
Right.
Clothing.
Same thing you do for EBT.
Yeah, and that way, you know, if you're just buying groceries or a pair of pants, you don't have to worry about the VAT.
Right.
And by the way, when I lived in Holland, their VAT system excluded non-prepared foods and clothing. So, you know, if you wanted to go to Albert Heijn or Jack Herman's to buy your groceries, as long as you didn't buy prepared foods, you were good to go. You didn't have to pay the VAT. You wanted to buy a nice suit, you just head downtown to the Centrum, buy a nice suit, no VAT. Everything else, you had to pay it. Now, they're paying 50% of their income in taxes plus an 18% VAT, which strikes me as very unfair. But sure, I'm all with Trump when he says, let's get rid of the income tax. I'm 100% behind him.
You just want better solutions.
Yeah, we're just not going to do it with tariffs. A, the math isn't there. You know, math is what it is.
It's not. No,
you're not going to fund.
It's not going to bring in the money.
Yeah, you're not going to fund $6.7 trillion in government spending whenever you only import $3.8 trillion a year. What is your tariff rate going to be? 240%? No.
Right.
So the only possible solution is a VAT. There is the fair tax, but that's not a VAT. That's a national sales tax. I have all sorts of problems with national sales taxes, largely because every OEC country that's tried to do it has failed at it because sales taxes are too easy to evade.
Yeah, there's ways to avoid it.
So, it would have to be a VAT. VATs have their own problems. What is the value you added?
Right. But at least it gets charged at the manufacturing delivery level, and everybody is participating.
Yeah, and you as a customer just pay whatever the price is on the sticker.
Right.
Although
that would make the Europeans happy. They can't stand coming over here and seeing the prices. That'd be like, and there's tax on top of that?
Yeah, look, we'd still have that. You still have state sales taxes. So you have this VAT.
You can't prevent the states from having sales taxes.
You can't prevent the states from having sales taxes. So even with a national VAT, we're still going to see sales taxes on, and we're still not going to know what something costs unless we do the sales tax calculation in our head before we buy it, just like we do now. For us, though, that's how we've lived forever, so we're used to it.
It's not even.
You know,
okay, so it's this.
The weird thing, because I remember I actually did this. I went in to buy something when I first got to Holland, when I first moved there. And I went in and bought something. And, you know, the price was, I don't know, actually, it was earlier than that. I was in Italy. I was TDY to Aviano, Italy. And I went in to buy something at some little Italian store. And the price on the item, I think, was like, 15,000 lira. And so I went up to the front and he said, okay, that's 15,000 lira. And I asked the guy, what's the tax?
Right.
And he looked at me like, I had asked him about growing a second head. He was like, it's 15,000 lira, dude. I'm like, that's what it costs. And so,
I grew up in Delaware. There was no sales tax.
Yeah. So the weird thing to me was was no sales tax. But that's a pleasant surprise. It's an unpleasant surprise when you're European and you said,
get
okay,
a little bit added on.
Yeah. You thought you knew what it was going to cost, but now we want 7.5%.
It said $14.99. I don't understand. Why not $14.99?
Plus tax. It's the plus tax that's the kicker. But that's how you'd have to do it. And it really, what I fear is Trump getting another great idea and finding some idiot in Congress who are going to play the, Reed Smalley part to have another Hoot Smalley tariff bill come through, and it's kind
Yeah,
of
I
be a
don't know. I'm
disaster.
not that worried about it. I got to be honest. I'm not that worried about it. I don't think that's going to happen. I really do think this is just a negotiating tactic.
Well, as long as that's all it is, fine. But again, the problem with it as a negotiating tactic is it has to work. And
True.
if the response is, yeah, okay, fine, we'll just put tariffs on your goods. Now what? Then it's not a very good tactic.
I don't know. It depends. I mean,
Well,
Canadians need to sell things here. And if it gets difficult, they're going to put pressure on their own government. Hey, can't we,
okay.
reinforce the border, eh?
And how long will that take? And in the interim, what is
Well, like I said,
the
I
cost
mean,
of everything we buy here?
So, but Trudeau is on his way out, right? And they have elections, I think, in March. Hopefully, Poilievre is going to win, and usher in a different type of government, not so commie and
Yeah, we'll see, but
overreaching.
what if the Liberal Party wins again?
Yeah, then we're kind of back to square one.
We're back to square one. It's not Pierre Trudeau, it's some other. Now, I think the NDP in Canada under Jagmeet Singh has already pretty much said they're throwing in with the progressive conservatives. And if so, then most likely Pierre Poilievre will be able to form a government with that party.
Right.
Not that the NDP is any great shakes as far as their policy. They've been perfectly happy to latch on to the Liberals in Canada for the past 12 years. So we'll see how that goes. But the thing is we are going to see it at the supermarket. We are going to see it when we go buy auto parts. We're going to see it pretty much everywhere we go because so much of, even of the stuff that we make here, so much of our manufacturing inputs comes from Canada. Now,
Yeah, especially automotive cars,
it
trucks.
is smart to say, well, we're only going to put a 10% tariff on energy because a 25% tariff on Canadian energy, we're going to see that everywhere. We're going to see it at the pump. We're going to see it all over the place. And we're probably still are going to see that at the pump. So I think the way that Trump frames it is not helpful. The way he talks about it, like the foreigners are going to pay. Foreigners don't pay tariffs.
Yeah.
It's not like they have to write a check every time they pull up a ship to the port or drive a truck across the border. Okay, we got to pay you X amount of money
But
to
how many
bring this
people
stuff
even
in.
understand
Well, they don't, but Trump should
that?
if he's going to talk about tariffs. And people, and I've seen people on X saying, yeah, we'll have these tariffs. We'll make the foreigners pay. No, you won't. They're not going to pay anything. You're going to pay it when you buy the good because you're the purchaser of the imported good. It's coming out of your pocket. He's taxing you. He's not taxing Pierre Trudeau or Claudia Sheinbaum.
Yeah, she's next in line, right?
Claudia Sheinbaum? No, she's the
Yeah.
president of Mexico.
Oh, no. Oh, that's right. No. There's a woman who's like basically VP to Trudeau.
Yeah, in the Liberal Party, look,
Yeah.
when Trudeau goes, they're going to have another leadership election. We don't really
Yeah.
know who's going to run
I think
the
she's leading, but I
Liberal
can't
Party.
remember what her name is.
Yeah, but I mean, m maybe she will, but hopefully, it'll be a progressive conservative party win that's large enough to allow Pierre
I totally
Poilievre to
missed
begin with.
the whole Sheinbaum thing where I didn't realize that AMLO wasn't there until like a month ago.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise to me, but honestly, I don't follow Mexican politics particularly closely, so
Didn't seem to be much point.
I'm always surprised by that Vicente Fox isn't the president of Mexico. That he hadn't been there for 30 years. So I don't know. I just this tariff talk and the way he talks about it worries me, and the lack of understanding about how tariffs work and the history of the really bad things that have happened when people started messing around with tariffs concerns me.
I think you're right to be concerned. I am too, but I'm not sure. First of all, it's nowhere near as aggressive as what Smoot-Hawley was.
Yeah, and 40 to 60%.
Secondly, we're not in the same kind of situation worldwide that we were in the 30s. So I think there are some countervailing things going on that make it possible to use this as a successful negotiating tactic. But I do agree with you. It's not, like I've said several times, it's not a solution. It's a tactic. Is it an effective tactic? Well, we'll find out. It did work with China for a while in Trump's first term.
Yeah, it works with China because we don't import anything to them. They are an entirely export-led economy. And so...
But they depend on us to buy their shit.
Yes. And so we have, you know, a type of leverage over them.
They're going to have to do something with those dollars.
Yeah. But we don't have that same kind of leverage with Canada and with Mexico.
That's true. Yeah.
And so while it might work against China, and maybe because it worked against China, who, again... They have a basically a 100% export economy for all practical
purposes. We sort of have a monopsony with them, yeah.
Yeah, so they really have to treat us with kid gloves and the West in general, because we don't give them anything. They don't buy anything from us. They're not rich enough to buy anything from us. So that's a one-way street. Trouble with both Canada and Mexico is our trade with them is not a one-way street. And so they can hurt us. Maybe not as badly as we can hurt them. Although, you know, Mexico and Canada are our two largest trading partners. We always think of China.
We start taxing those remittances and...
That is a tool that we have for them. And by the way, that's the tool I would have used first.
Yes, absolutely. I'm surprised that has not been done yet.
I would have just said, okay, then fine. We're not going to put, I wouldn't have put tariffs on Canada. There are other tools in the toolbox. That's the thing that gets me. With Mexico, we have the remittances tool. Outside of petroleum, remittances from the United States are the largest source of hard currency in Mexico.
Something like $63 billion, $65
billion? Yeah, 100% tariff on remittances would be crippling to them. Or it wouldn't be a tariff. It'd be a tax on remittances.
An excise tax.
Yeah, that would be crippling to them. That would be the tool I grabbed out of the toolbox first for Mexico. With Canada, it's more complicated, but I think there are other tools than tariffs that we could impose on them. Because once you impose the tariffs, they can impose them back on you, and they can, to at least some degree, impose almost as much pain on you as you impose on them.
Well, they're going to be the 51st state, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that will never happen, because if there's one thing that the Canadians dislike more than the Quebecois, would be the Americans. Canadians know they're not Americans, and Canadians don't want to be Americans.
They don't even want to be one state.
No, they barely want to be the same country.
Be one country,
for goodness sakes. So they certainly don't want to be part of our country. So we'll see how that turns out. Like I said, it's
we'll just start shooting missiles at them from Greenland, and then.
Look, I think the Greenland thing is more defensible, and I think we actually have We actually have a shot at getting a hell of a lot more access to and control over Greenland.
We are pissing the fuck out of Denmark, though.
Yeah, well, you know, that seems to be Trump's way. Let's see if I can piss you off first and then get reasonable later. I not a tactic I would choose. Again, temperamentally, Donald Trump irritates me because I just don't have that same level of temperament. But, well, it's something that we'll watch. But we're not going to watch it anymore tonight because we are done, Michael. As always, it's a pleasure. We'll talk to you again next week.
All right, it's good seeing you, bud.
All right, good seeing you. Love you too, man. And for the rest of you, that's it for us. Have a great week. Sorry that we had a hiatus last week. We'll try to keep that minimized here for the next little while. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week. So long.